Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. James Carville had a message for President Obama today. Tell BP, I'm your daddy. Well, Obama is now in his first news conference in 10 months telling reporters BP will do what the government tells it to do. We'll have more on Obama's news conference later in the program. But first, news. Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar announced today that the head of the agency in charge of offshore drilling, the Minerals Management Service, stepped down under pressure. A government task force now says the disaster is worse than the Exxon Valdez spill. Marine scientists say a massive new oil plume is headed to Mobile Bay, Alabama. Joining us, Joel Achenbach, national reporter for The Washington Post. Joel, what is the latest on stopping the oil? There have also been reports all morning, all day, that the Coast Guard Commandant, Thad Allen, said that the leak was completely stopped. Then that was pulled back. What do we know?
Yeah, I think he went a little too far there, Robin. It looks like mud coming out of the riser pipe now, not oil and gas. We'd been seeing all this oil and gas, and Doug Suttles of BP confirmed that to them it looks like it's just mud coming out. Now, so what that means is that at the moment there is not oil and gas coming out of the well. Now, that doesn't mean the well is plugged. What you want is you want the mud not only to shoot out the cracks and the leaks in the top of the riser pipe, you want that mud to go down into the well bore some 2.5 miles and essentially render the well static. And I think that they are still pumping away, and they don't know if they've achieved that yet. When they think that they've got the pressure totally under control, then they'll send down the cement. When they do that and the cement plug is in there, then I think we'll have an announcement that will say that this well is dead. When is that going to happen? I don't know. I think that Allen may have, though, have jumped the gun a little bit by indicating that the well had been killed. It has not been killed yet, according to BP.
Right. Well, what do we know also about these new estimations of how much oil there is? Two different teams of scientists in Louisiana who've been studying the amount of oil that's been released so far said this morning it's at least twice and possibly five times as high as previously thought.
Yeah, that's big news today because, you know, as a reporter covering this, we've constantly struggled with, well, how do you describe the rate of the leak? The early estimate of 5,000 barrels a day was something that came out of NOAA, the federal government, early on. Then after that, the officials never really wanted to go near the estimate. Outside scientists said it looks like it could be a lot more. In fact, one scientist from Purdue testified that he thought it was 95,000 barrels a day. Now what we have finally is we have these two teams that have looked both at the surface slick and at the video feed of what's coming out of the leaks, and they're saying 12,000 to 19,000 barrels a day. The significance there is, number one, yes, it's several times at least the official amount previously, but more than that, it lets us know the scale of this disaster. We know now it's the largest oil spill in American history. Mm-hmm. It's significantly larger than the Exxon Valdez disaster.
And it happened on the watch of Elizabeth Birnbaum, who has been the head of the MMS since 2009. She was a lawyer, worked on the Hill for 23 years. Both sides of the aisle have said that she inherited the problems at MMS, considered the most dysfunctional agency in Washington, literally sleeping with the oil industry that it's supposed to oversee. She was supposed to end that cozy relationship. She's either been fired or resigned, depending on reports today. Your thoughts on her response to all this?
I don't really have a take on her specifically because I have not been covering that part of the story. But obviously, MMS has emerged as the villain, you know, of this whole narrative. Yesterday, Ken Salazar said, you know, most people who work for that agency are good people, but there are some bad apples in it. I have not heard anyone say that Ms. Birnbaum was one of the bad apples, but they're reorganizing the place. They're going to break it apart. Someone had to fall on his or her sword, and so, it was her turn. But I can't say that anyone has alleged that she personally has done anything wrong. It's just that agency is now tainted, to use a mild term, and So she's out the door.
Well, and her supporters say she's worked around the clock, and maybe no one person could reverse the situation at MMS that had been building up for years. But she certainly didn't go down when the well blew. Other Interior Ministry officials did. She did not go initially, so she's going now. Joel Achenbach, national reporter for The Washington Post, thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, it's been a week of accusations and saber-rattling on the Korean Peninsula. The South charging the North with sinking a South Korean warship back in March, killing 46 sailors. The North denying that. Today, South Korea conducted large-scale military exercises. North Korea warned of immediate physical strikes if southern ships enter North Korean waters. Let's start in Seoul, South Korea, with Christian Science Monitor correspondent Donald Kirk to find out how the people are feeling. Donald, Koreans have lived with this divide, you know, a ceasefire but not a peace, since 1953. But what are South Koreans feeling today?
Well, of course, you get a range of reactions. Some people say, oh, I'm scared. Some people blame the government of President Lee Myung-bak for exacerbating tensions. Some are totally behind the government, and many predict that, well, after a period of tension, they'll be calm again, as has happened after a number of other crises and problems and acts of terrorism over the years. Certainly, there is a whole sense of uneasiness that perhaps this time it won't go away that easily. There's all kinds of potential for renewed clashes, and the government continues to talk quite tough. There is, however, another sense that President Lee, for all his seeming hardline attitude, really wants to do all possible to avoid a renewal of open conflict. He's a business tycoon, a former chairman of Hyundai Engineering and Construction, very much interested in revving up the Korean economy and improving all kinds of business relationships. So obviously the mere idea of war, the threat of war, is not going to do the economy any good. And he's very much focused on economic issues.
Well, we want to talk more about the geopolitical aspects of this and even the possibility of war, and we're going to do that in a few minutes. But let's just stay with the people, because you're reporting, for instance, something that many Americans don't even know about, that North and South Korea share, in effect, a factory complex. Tell us about the Kaesong Economic Complex. I mean, to some, this would be impossible. People from the North and the South actually working together.
Right. Well, that's about 40 miles north of Seoul, just across the line between the two Koreas, just above the demilitarized zone. I was actually up in that direction today. I was at a promontory called Dorasan, overlooking the highway that was built by Hyundai engineers, and beside a railroad, also a rail line also built by Hyundai, that goes into that factory complex. I saw traffic moving into the complex. North Korea has not shut it down.
Donald, you paint a picture of 100 South Korean factories in this area. South Koreans are the technicians and managers, and they direct more than 40,000 North Korean workers on assembly lines.
Right. About 1,000 technicians and managers operate these factories, and more than 40,000 North Korean workers. The prime benefit for North Korea is they make about $50 million a year out of it. A lot of it, if not most of it, from wages that are supposedly going to the workers, but the workers never see, of course. It's in hard currency that's gobbled up by North Korea and goes into their coffers. The factory has long been viewed as a tremendous achievement of reconciliation policy of the previous decade before President Lee was inaugurated in February of 2008. However, it's a very confined and tightly controlled complex, and North Korea really maintains extremely tight watch on all the workers there. They have no relationships with the technicians and managers other than those of learning what's going on, of learning how to do their jobs and accepting instructions on how to get their job done.
Well, that was going to be our question, because we wondered what kind of membrane is there now between the people in the North and the South. We spoke recently to reporter Barbara Demick. Her terrific book is called Nothing to Envy. It follows North Korean defectors as they come into the South. And so how many people from the South now know people in the North, where we know they are still supplementing their diets with picked grass, their neighbors are still assigned to spy on each other, there's no pictures of families allowed? So how much of that kind of awareness is seeping from the South into the North? I mean, how much does the North know about how cramped and cult-like their lives are? How much flow is there between the people?
Well, there's a sense that North Koreans, some North Koreans, on a highly limited basis, but nevertheless a significant number perhaps, are learning more about life in the South. Several South Korean shortwave stations that broadcast into North Korea 1 or 2 hours a day. Of course, it's totally illegal and quite a severe crime, in fact, to be caught listening to South Korean broadcasts. But nonetheless, some of this is getting through. Also, people believe that North Koreans are seeing some DVDs and CDs from the South and perhaps even tuning in somehow to South Korean TV. There is some influence, but it's not that much. It's easy to exaggerate on it. Nonetheless, it's more than it was a few years ago, and it may be growing. About 20,000 North Koreans have made their way to South Korea, but they don't come across the demilitarized zone, the line between the two Koreas. They go north across the mainly across the Tumen River into China, and from China they try to get to South Korea, either directly or indirectly via Vietnam or Thailand. So North Koreans obviously are aware that there's a better life in South Korea, but you don't see real unrest in North Korea. You don't see the regime of Kim Jong-il being undermined, and you don't see high-level North Korean defectors very much. You see a few, but not very many. Most of the defectors are very much outside the stratum of the elite. And interestingly, about 80% of them are women.
Well, I guess, Donald, the question was, you know, how much of a role will the people of either the North or the South play in this crisis? Or are they just on the sidelines watching their leaders, you know, play it out? And then what are the questions to be asked now? You pose many of them at the end of a recent article. You know, you write, what if the North does stage another attack or shoots back at those South Korean loudspeakers?
Right. The South Korean government needs popular support for his rather hardline policy. He needs people to believe the result of the investigation in which they've offered fairly convincing proof that a torpedo fired by a North Korean submarine was indeed responsible for sinking the Chonan. You'd be surprised that quite a few people still don't want to believe that report. They're not prepared to believe it. I talked to someone today who just said she really didn't think it was true and couldn't it have been an accident and, you know, and so forth. And there are even people who say, well, maybe South Korea blew up the ship in order to bring charges against North Korea. Now, that view is going down. But we're going to see we're going to learn more about how people feel on June 2nd when there are local elections throughout South Korea for provincial assemblies and councils. The government, the conservative government, expects to win big. But there's still going to be some interesting responses elsewhere, and I think you'll find in these election results some real skepticism about what President Lee is doing. And you're not going to find much support, if any, for a renewal of conflict that might bring about the possibility of a second Korean War.
Donald Kirk of the Christian Science Monitor, speaking from Seoul, South Korea. Donald, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
We're talking about the flare-up in the Korean Peninsula. Let's bring in Stephen Haggard. He's professor of Korea-Pacific Studies and director of the Korea-Pacific Program at the University of California, San Diego. Professor, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton admonished the North for sinking the South Korean warship, but is also calling for the South to show strategic patience, which many read as taking a long view rather than reacting. But then you have Brian Myers, a professor at Danseo University in Busan, South Korea. He says, I think we're going to see something big, that the conservative South Korean president, Lee Myung-bak, standing up to North Korea will threaten them. So your thoughts. What do you think happens next?
Well, obviously a complex picture. The United States, of course, has the long-run strategic objective of denuclearizing the peninsula. And the mechanism for doing that has been the six-party talks that include the Russians, the Japanese, the two Koreas, China, and the United States. So at the current juncture, we're really tied to the South Korean government's response. And needless to say, the populace is quite upset. It's important that he take a firm stand. But viewed over the longer run, we have to see this as an effort to get the North Koreans back into these multilateral talks.
And is there a way to help North Korea perhaps save face. President Lee has also said that, you know, maybe the North Korean leader Kim Jong-il just got some bad advice from his generals, and he took out a South Korean warship in response to the destruction of a North Korean patrol boat last November, and that maybe there's a way to sort of, behind the scenes, help North Korea make their way through this. What do you think is going on behind the scenes?
Well, we don't really know exactly what North Korean motives were. Even if we do find out definitively, I haven't read the report, that the North Koreans are responsible for this. We don't know whether it was inadvertent. We don't know if it was planned at the top. We don't know if this was something that involved the military possibly even acting on its own. But in any case, I think you make an important point that there has to be a way for the North Koreans to stand down from this.
Is that where Chinese can perhaps help out? Explain China's role in all of this.
Well, China has very complex motives with respect to the Korean Peninsula, because on the one hand, they have tremendous leverage if they choose to exercise it over North Korea. North Korea trades very extensively with China. It's heavily dependent on food and fuel imports from China. But on the other hand, the exercise of that leverage creates a lot of risk for China, because they're the ones who get the refugees. They're the ones who face the instability on their border. So basically, the Chinese have really been extremely cautious in pressuring the North Koreans. And anything they are doing, they're probably doing behind the scenes.
Do you see reunification anywhere on the, you know, even towards the horizon?
Well, I always say to my students, I don't expect to see reunification in my lifetime. And given the fact I have a few years left, I don't see it as a short-term prospect. What we really mean by reunification at this point, I think, is something more akin to detente than really a full-blown absorption of North Korea. I think the stability of the North Korean regime tends to be underestimated. It's a highly developed national security state. It has a very strong internal police apparatus. It has a large gulag of prison camps. It has a large military. I don't think that this place is going to simply fall apart or disappear as much as we might like that to be the case. And so the real game is, how do you engage with North Korea? How do you try to transform it at the margin so that at least we could see an evolution along, let's say, a Chinese path, you know, a reformist path in which you may still have single-party rule, but which in, you see a relaxation.
But you see in North Korea even a whiff of what we see in China, which was its own economic engine. I mean, yes, we talked about the shared factory facility with the South, with South Korea, but is there any other economic engine?
Well, it's easy to take the last 4 or 5 years as evidence that North Korea is really moving in an anti-reform direction. But it is important to remember that in 2002, the government attempted a big reform. It has tried to open up venues like Kaesong. It has played around with other export processing zones. And what's happened is that the conflict between the United States and the North Korea and South Korea, its regional partners, has made it difficult for reformers within North Korea to have a voice. You know, the turn away from reform is related to the nuclear crisis. And so the resolution of the nuclear crisis might also open the door to at least some reform. I don't want to, you know, mislead your listeners. This isn't going to move rapidly in a Chinese direction, but at the margin, that's what we want to see. We want to see a reforming North Korea.
What are your concerns in the very short term of missteps that North Korea might make, that, or South Korea, or the U.S., that, you know, missteps that might derail some of these long-term hopes you have?
Well, I'm a little bit less alarmist than some of the press. I think in the short run, the important thing for the United States and South Korea is not to take military actions that cross the border, in effect, such as attacking a North Korean facility. We don't want to escalate the military side of this. We want to focus on the defense, focus on establishing the credibility of the deterrent. And then what we can do is we can hold out the prospect for reengagement through the six-party process. South Koreans have already taken quite drastic actions with respect to cutting economic ties north-south. So the North Koreans have gotten the message that this is a serious issue for the South.
And if the North Koreans do stage another attack in those disputed waters where the South Korean ship was sunk, or if they've been threatening to shoot out the loudspeakers on the DMZ that have been pouring propaganda into the North, they've been threatening to attack them, should those just be overlooked?
I personally think that the North Koreans are unlikely to do that. I suspect the loudspeaker idea is not a particularly good idea at this juncture. The signal has already been sent by the South through the cutting off of economic assistance. We just want a situation in which both sides can reassess and try to get back to the talks. Again, this is an issue of trying to provide a mechanism where the North Koreans can stand down.
Stephen Haggard, professor of Korea-Pacific Studies and director of the Korea-Pacific Program at the University of California, San Diego. Professor, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure.
In India, bribes are a part of doing business. They don't always call them bribes. When cashing a check or applying for a loan or an ID card, an official might ask for a little extra for tea. But then there's no tea. In 2001, a physics professor at the University of Maryland came up with an idea to help eliminate this bribery in his native India. The zero rupee. It's printed on plain paper with a big zero on it. It isn't legal tender. It isn't worth anything. But it's become a valuable symbol, sending a message about corruption. Today, nearly a million zero rupee notes have been distributed by a group called Fifth Pillar. Let's learn about them. Vijay Anand is the president of Fifth Pillar. He joins us from the Christian Science Monitor studio in Washington. Vijay, how bad is bribery in India?
Corruption starts right before birth until death for an Indian citizen. The parents have to pay a bribe to the nursing staff to even know the sex of the baby. If it is a girl child, you pay lesser. If it is a boy child, you pay a little more bribe. So that is where it starts for an Indian citizen. And right after getting discharged from the hospital, it's the obtaining the birth certificate. Then when you go to school, obtaining a school admission, you have to pay a bribe. Then to get a job, you have to pay a bribe. To obtain a business license, to file your taxes, and then eventually it goes on until you retire. And to get your monthly pension check, you need to pay bribes. Then when you die, your family has to pay a bribe to get your death certificate. So for a single Indian citizen, it does not stop even after death.
Well, and we understand it becomes a vicious cycle, because if somebody has to pay a huge bribe, let's say, to secure a contract, then they feel, well, I have to recoup that money, so they collect bribes from people beneath them.
Everybody that takes bribes also have to pay bribes in other departments, so nobody is immune. So that is why Fifth Pillar found it very necessary to start distributing the zero rupee notes.
So tell us a little bit about those notes.
The zero rupee helps the individual to say no to corruption, no to bribery, without having to utter a word. It sends a sense of fear to the corrupt official that is handed this note, because there are quite a few things in the Indian law that makes corruption punishable by jail time, by suspension from their respective jobs. And the corrupt official has forgotten those things and assumed that the citizen will never confront their wrong thinking or acts.
Well, paint a scenario for us. There's a case that we read about of someone who went in to open a charity, and he had to get permission and the licensing and everything. And the Indian official said, there's a little business we have to take care of. We need some money for tea. And so the person just hands over this zero note. What happens?
Well, when the zero rupee note is handed, apart from the number zero and the word zero printed on it, it also has our organization's name printed in bold, along with the full contact information comprising of the street address, telephone number, website, and everything. And that makes a strong statement that the citizen is not alone in this fight against corruption. He or she is part of a larger organization that is waiting to act if a corrupt official delays or denies a fundamental right to a citizen. So in the past, they would find all kinds of excuses to delay the job and use code words to evince a bribe. But when the zero rupee note is handed out, they are stumped and they do not have an alternative other than to get the job done.
You say that anecdotally, at least, you've had occasions where officials get the note and then immediately sort of rescind the request for a bribe. But have there also been cases, or is there a fear there will be cases of retribution?
Not at all until now. Touch wood, not one case has been reported to us where the zero rupee note has complicated the situation for a citizen.
How much will that impact people negatively? Because we understand that there are people who have begun to consider a bribe a part of their pay.
Well, I agree, but I think they ought to find alternatives to increase their paychecks by either fighting for a better pay or quitting the job and taking a job that gives them a better pay. Definitely taking bribes and involving in corrupt practices is not an alternative for a bad paycheck.
But as you probably know, some economists believe that bribery may be a good thing because it gets things done quickly.
When we are talking about 80% of India cannot afford to pay those bribes, it is really a crippling factor in day-to-day lives of the common man in India.
Vijay Anand is the president of Fifth Pillar, an activist group in India that wants to reduce corruption by having people hand out worthless 0 rupees when asked for a bribe. For more, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org. Vijay, thanks so much.
Thanks very much, Robin. I appreciate it.
Okay, up next, oceanographer Sylvia Earle on the damage done to deepwater sea life by the BP well. You're listening to Here and Now. Today, marine scientists announced the discovery of a massive new plume of what they believe to be oil beneath the Gulf of Mexico, stretching 22 miles from the leaking BP wellhead towards Alabama's Mobile Bay. And as we said earlier, even though the top kill may be slowing that flow of oil, the U.S. Geological Survey today declared that the BP Gulf disaster has surpassed the 1989 Exxon Valdez as the nation's worst oil accident. And the head of the Mineral Management Service that regulates the oil industry and offshore drilling has resigned under pressure. All of this as tomorrow President Obama heads to the Gulf Coast to survey the scope of the damage that so far claimed the lives of jellyfish, hundreds of birds, and dozens of turtles. But what else? That's the question posed by oceanographer Sylvia Earle. Earle is former chief scientist for the U.S. National Oceanic and Administrative Administration, NOAA. We spoke with her after she testified to Congress earlier this month about the environmental effect of the oil spill and asked her to lay out her concerns.
Well, concerns are several. One is that we're inadequately equipped or prepared to respond to a deep spill. We don't know where the oil is going. We don't see the consequences of what's actually happening because we don't have the equipment to go out there and just look at the fate of the oil or even measure how much is coming out. That's one problem. Another is the broadcast approach to the use of dispersants to keep the oil from coming ashore, where the perception is that that's where the problem is along the coast. And of course it is for those who have beachfront property. It's a big problem for marshes, for birds that are nesting. The strategic use, sort of a last gasp measure of the application of dispersants might be advised and approved, but to just use it as a cosmetic tool to reduce the appearance of a problem should just simply stop. When most people don't actually think of the ocean as a living system. They think of it as rocks and water, perhaps, with a few fish, but it's a living minestrone. The water is filled with life, and that's where we really need to recognize that the damage is occurring. It's not just the surface, it's the ocean itself.
A couple other criticisms we're hearing. BP has refused to permit scientists to send equipment to the ocean floor so that they could take their own readings of the rate of the gush. Also, the administration hasn't released any test results of water from the deep ocean.
I'm not sure what measurements thus far have been made. There needs to be transparency about what is happening. We're really angry at BP and Transocean, and we're angry at the government, but we need to hold up the mirror and say, why is this happening at all? It's because of our eagerness to exploit whatever reserves are out there to drive our hunger for cheap energy. But as it's proving, cheap energy is literally costing the earth and the ocean. Now, perhaps we have a greater incentive to look for alternatives and to be prepared to deal with problems when they occur. And we are not prepared. We don't have submersibles available for scientists or for the government officials to go out and actually be able to provide not just an assessment of the problem, but to solve the problem. And we're leaving the solving of the problem and even the assessing of the problem in the hands of the industry itself.
Well, Sylvia Earle, you're the former chief scientist at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The current is Jane Lubichenco. She's taking a lot of criticism, people saying that the agency should either step in or should have been more preventive. Do you think that criticism is fair?
I have tremendous respect for Dr. Lubichenco. She is the best person I can imagine to be heading NOAA. I think this, a lot of what has happened has caught not just NOAA, but the world, not exactly by surprise, but it's taken a little while for the magnitude of this to sink in. I think NOAA is mobilizing the ships and aircraft and so on, but they're not prepared. No agency is prepared to look with what is really required to go under the surface. The United States does not have submersibles to actually go out and take scientists, take observers, take reporters, take anybody who wants to go view what the water column is doing, what the ocean floor is doing, and it's only a mile away. I mean, a mile in any other direction, high in the sky or on the level, is easy to gain access to. And the ocean we now understand is not only critical to everything we care about, our economies, our health, our security, but fundamentally, the ocean is driving the way the world works, governing climate, governing weather, thermoregulating the temperature. We have climate change, we have sea level rise, and now we also have ocean acidification. The ocean is in trouble, and therefore we're in trouble. The biggest concern should be about, of course, the spill, but also fundamentally what the consumption of fossil fuels is doing to the planet and to our future. And so knowing what is going on in the ocean and having the capacity to explore, to monitor, to be there. Right now, how do you do it? You send a camera. Why not send people there? When we do send people on site, whether it's high in the sky or deep in the sea, there's a qualitative difference in what you can see and what you can learn. And we have basically been blind and have allowed the technologies that would enable us to be able to understand what's happening in the Gulf of Mexico as one clear example. Right now, there are only four vehicles, and there are four countries. Russia, Japan, France, and China have the capability to go to half the ocean's depths, a little more than that, 6,000, or in the case of China, 7,000 meters. But the ocean is 11,000 meters deep in its deepest area within U.S. waters, of the Mariana Trench. Why don't we have access there? The area of the United States that is actually submerged, if you go out to the edge of the exclusive economic zone, is larger than the rest of the country put together. And yet we don't have access there. We don't know what's there. We know how to exploit it, but we haven't yet explored it.
That's Sylvia Earle, oceanographer and former chief scientist for NOAA. Let me try to get it right this time. That's the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. She testified before Congress this week, and we spoke to her early this week. This note, a spokesperson for the West Jefferson Medical Center in New Orleans now says seven workers helping to clean up the Gulf oil spill remain hospitalized after falling ill, working on boats off the coast. Doctors say they believe the likely cause is chemical irritation, but also dehydration due to long hours out there in the heat. About 120 commercial boats are working on cleanup in Breton Sound, just southeast of New Orleans. Take a quick break, here and now. Today, President Obama said that from day one, he and his administration have been calling the shots in how to stop the oil gushing into the Gulf Coast. It's not BP.
The American people should know that from the moment this disaster began, the federal government has been in charge of the response effort. As far as I'm concerned, BP is responsible for this horrific disaster, and we will hold them fully accountable on behalf of the United States, as well as the people and communities victimized by this tragedy. We will demand that they pay every dime they owe for the damage they've done and the painful losses that they've caused.
The president in some ways came out swinging at his first news conference in almost 10 months, trying to quell criticism that he hasn't done enough to end the five-week-old oil crisis. Rick Klein is senior Washington news editor for ABC World News. Rick, do you think the president responded to his critics, including James Carville, a longtime Democratic operative, of course, but Louisiana native, who said the president needed to tell BP, "I'm your daddy"?
Yeah, I think he's certainly trying to. I think that the disappearance is a response to that. He'll be in the region, of course, later in the week, trying to show the robust nature of the federal response. I think the tone that we heard from him at the press conference was, look, we are in charge. Make no mistake, the federal government is in charge. But he really stopped short, I think, of accepting full responsibility at a couple of different junctures, asked specifically about whether everything could be done. He sort of acknowledged some mistakes, some oversights, and some areas where maybe federal agencies weren't up to the task, but generally tried to deflect that criticism.
Well, you speak of agencies. We mentioned early in the program the head of the Minerals Management Service, the agency responsible for offshore oil leases, was forced to step down today. The president talked about the level of corruption at that agency when he entered office.
For years, there has been a scandalously close relationship between oil companies and the agency that regulates them. That's why we've decided to separate the people who permit the drilling from those who regulate and ensure the safety of the drilling.
But Rick Klein, the president also made some admissions. He said he wrongly felt that oil companies had their act together when it came to disasters. He was asked by someone, now that we know that scientists also said today that even more oil is gushing out than thought, this has passed Exxon Valdez, how can you trust anything BP says? And the president responded, you know, maybe that's a mistake he did make.
Yeah, I think mistakes in deferring early on to BP in terms of the response, in terms of the information. You get the sense of a president who's trying to catch up. This storyline and this tragedy has been moving very quickly. And while he has said the federal government has been engaged since day one, he hasn't been in the region for almost a month now. He is finally going back there and realizing that things have not gone the way they can. And the folks in Louisiana, you mentioned James Carville among them, really crying out for presidential leadership, really wanting him to get far more involved than he has been personally, knowing that the presidential leadership tends to cut some red tape. You see some changes at the head of MMS today, but then again, President Obama said he didn't even know for sure whether Elizabeth Birnbaum was fired or resigned on her own.
Well, you know, the president is in a tough spot that others, including the BBC, characterized it this way today. It caught me that he is a president who's being asked to have complete control of a situation that in some ways, including legally, he doesn't have any control of. People wanted to take action, to send the government or Coast Guard, but the government doesn't have sophisticated underwater robots sitting there waiting. But also, legally, BP is responsible for the cleanup.
I think from the beginning there's been these two conflicting pressures that the White House has faced. On the one hand, they want to say, yes, we've been on the case since day one. We are doing everything and bringing the full resources of the federal government to bear, coordinating our efforts. On the other hand, they want to say, and rightfully so, this is someone else's disaster. It's a private company that did this. They have primary responsibility for containing it, for cleaning it up. So it has been a difficult balancing act, and I think the president would probably admit in a candid moment that it hasn't been something that they've pulled off successfully at every turn.
Well, meanwhile, he's heading to the region. He's going to be meeting and, you know, coming face to face with these people. Now, the Coast Guard says BP is having some success slowing the leak with that top kill, but the fix isn't done yet. And meanwhile, another huge plume has been discovered by scientists. And this plume might have been created, by the way, by dispersants down by the well. And, you know, this oil is now reformed in this huge plume. The president acknowledged today that he knows people are worried.
We'll make sure that when all is said and done, the victims of this disaster will get the relief that they are owed. We're not going to abandon our fellow citizens. We'll help them recover, and we will help them rebuild.
Rick Klein, what other concrete things, no pun intended since concrete's involved here, but what other concrete things did the president say his administration is going to do right now to address concerns about offshore drilling? We know some, I think every exploratory well in the Gulf is going to be closed, at least for now.
That's right. There are a couple of exploratory efforts, including one up in the Alaska area, that are now put on hold pending more environmental reviews. Everything is going to be, functionally speaking, there's not going to be anything that moves forward until there's at least a review of what went wrong here and what the mistakes and the problems are inside the Mineral Management Service. I think that's the least that we can say. He is, though, saying that he continues to believe that offshore oil drilling has to be part of America's energy future. He said he didn't regret the speech that he gave just 2 months ago, where he said that we need to be more aggressive in seeking out these new energy sources. That's a speech that a lot on the left really were hoping that he'd never give. He's not backing down from that position, but clearly he's reversing himself in terms of what should be taking place more immediately.
The president has reportedly lost his famous cool in recent days, you know, the no-drama Obama, yelling at aides to plug the damn hole. Republicans say he was pretty testy in a meeting about immigration reform. And he's made comments today like, you never heard me say drill, baby, drill. So what's your sense of how, of his comportment, which, you know, this is the man that many are looking to for just that?
That's right. And look, it's a difficult leadership challenge. Whenever you have a natural disaster, or in this case, a man-made disaster with an environmental catastrophe, you get pressed and you get, there's an expectation, I think, an unreasonable one, that the president can snap his fingers and make it all happen. That said, there is a role of presidential leadership in times of crises. People look to the president for leadership in the federal government, and it has an undeniable impact on focusing press attention and also focusing resources attention and cutting through red tape. And that's where I think really the critique is particularly biting. Because this has not been a president who seems to have rushed to be out in front on this. It's taken him a long time to respond directly to these things, and you still hear complaints from local officials about unreturned calls, about offers, and about suggestions that are just basically are not being listened to at all.
Now, a quick question, Rick Klein. Some are saying, and this has to be pretty brief, I know, for what it's going to be. Some are saying this is a place where 11 people died, and we now know decisions were made to save money. Did the president, has anyone talked about this being, you know, almost a crime scene?
You know, that's an interesting point. I think we're beginning to see that. The Justice Department has asked for documents to be preserved around this. There's been several congressional investigations that are launched, and I think increasingly we're going to see exactly what you're talking about.
Rick Klein, Senior Washington News Editor for ABC World News. Rick, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Back in a minute, here and now. The great baseball pitcher Robert Leroy Satchel Paige used to say, age is a case of mind over matter. If you don't mind, it don't matter. Well, by most accounts, Satchel Paige was almost 60 years old when he threw his last pitch from a big league mound. By then, of course, he was past his prime. His best years were spent as one of the brightest stars of the Negro Leagues in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, when Major League Baseball was for whites only. When Jackie Robinson broke baseball's color barrier with the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1947, Satchel Paige was angry and hurt. He felt he should have been first. He was eventually signed by the Cleveland Indians a year after Robinson, and he pitched Cleveland to the World Series, but his major league career was limited to parts of just six seasons. Still, in 1971, Satchel Paige received baseball's highest honor. He was inducted into the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York, the first player honored solely for his outstanding play in the Negro Leagues rather than the Major Leagues.
And so I guess all that got me up here to Cooperstown, somewhere that I didn't have any dreams back when I come in baseball or getting, but the little poem I wrote about Don't Never Look Back, Something May Be Gaining on You, that kept me going.
Satchel Paige, who died in 1982, speaking at his Hall of Fame induction ceremony in 1971. Journalist Larry Tye is the author of a fascinating biography of Satchel Paige. It's called Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend. It's now out in paperback, which gives us a chance to revisit a conversation Here Now's Alex Ashlock had with Larry last year.
One of the places that I became intrigued about Satchel Paige. I grew up hearing about him from my father every time we went to a Red Sox game and realized that he, like most people, only knew an inch deep of Satchel Paige. And I got an inch or deeper than that when I spent a year and a half traveling around the country talking to aging Pullman porters who had served Satchel when he would ride the trains with his teams, particularly in his later days in the major leagues, and who adored Satchel. He may have been, at that time, the most venerated black man in America, partly because he was such a great athlete and partly because he was such a sensational showman and a proud figure.
What made him so special as a pitcher?
He had two things that were quite extraordinary. One was he threw the ball so fast and hard that his catchers would have to put a beefsteak between their hand and the baseball glove so they wouldn't end up with burning hands at the end of the game. He threw it with such accuracy that he'd go out before the game and throw 10 out of 10 pitches over a postage stamp that he would put down on home plate. The idea of combining speed like that with control like that, with durability to last 40 years, is something that baseball fans will argue from here till the end of the millennium over who the best pitcher of all times was. There is no question that the best pitcher for the longest time was Satchel Paige.
He was very good at creating his own legend as well, wasn't he? You talked about the throwing the ball over the postage stamp on the stamp on the plate. He said, I think I could take the frosting off a cake with my fastball. He was very good at creating himself as a sort of a legend in his own time.
He was in two ways. One is he was eloquent, and he said things like what you just said. He said his most famous statement that got him into Bartlett's Book of Quotations was, "Don't look back, something might be gaining on you." So he was eloquent. He had the facts and the performance to back up his boasts, and he needed to fan his legend in a way that guys like Babe Ruth and Joe DiMaggio and Ted Williams didn't. Satchel was black. He was playing for his prime years in the shadows of the Negro League, this racially segregated world of baseball that few reporters and not nearly as many fans as were watching the major leagues were out there. And so he had to create a little bit of mystery, do a tiny bit of embellishment to make people realize that he was on par with these great white stars who reporters created a legend for.
Remind our listeners just how important the Negro Leagues were in the black community, how big a deal it was for them to go see a pitcher like Satchel Paige.
If I could, I'd like you to take you to a Sunday Negro Leagues game in cities all across America. It was a time when women got out their best shoes, put on their mink stoles, spent a week preparing their hair. Men took out their patent leather shoes and their straw hats. Ministers let church out early, not just so the congregants could make it to the baseball game, but so they could make it. And every big Sunday baseball game featured Satchel Paige. This was black society. It was the one time during the week where African Americans could let down their hair, really put aside all the slights that they had to suffer the rest of the week, and just be themselves with their friends and their neighbors and watch wonderful, hard-edged baseball.
Why wasn't Satchel Paige the black ball player that crossed the color line? Why was it Jackie Robinson? It seems like Satchel Paige would have been, he was there, he certainly was talented enough. Why wasn't it him?
He asked that question of himself. When the announcement was made that Jackie was signed in 1945 by Branch Rickey to break the color barrier, Satchel started out with a perfect PC answer. He said, Jackie was the right guy, you couldn't have picked a better guy. When he said that, my guess is he was having an ulcer, because that was not what he felt. And what he said later on was, I'm the guy who got all these people looking at the Negro Leagues. I'm the guy who got all these people looking at my Kansas City Monarchs team and their second-string second baseman, Jackie Robinson. I'm the guy that ought to have been first.
We're in Red Sox territory, obviously, here in Massachusetts, and he pitched his last game in the major leagues against the Red Sox. He was pitching for the Kansas City Athletics. This was in 1965, I believe. Charlie Finley had signed him kind of as a publicity stunt, I guess, to bring in some fans. Tell us a little bit about that final game.
So Satchel was set up in the bullpen with a rocking chair, with a nurse in a white uniform, and with his personal water boy. And it was all part of Charlie Finley was a great showman, and he had a show here. He thought Satchel would come in, he'd get bombed, but he had filled up the stands. People were there to see Satchel, and Satchel, as always, never disappointed. He was 59 years old, which was exactly 30 years older than his catcher that night, and even his teammates were saying, this guy belongs in a nursing home, not out here on the diamond. So he goes out, he pitches against a Red Sox team where the only guy to get a hit was Carl Yastrzemski, shuts them out in three innings, comes back onto the field afterwards, they dim the lights, they play, and everybody sings that old gray mare, and in tribute to him, all these tens of thousands of fans flick on matches and lighters to basically say, we love you, Satchel.
In the end, Larry Tye, what do you think Satchel Paige's legacy is? What is his place, or where is his place in the pantheon of American sports heroes or American legends?
In sports heroes, he is the longest-lasting great pitcher in the history of baseball. And in the history of America, starting with a presumption, which I think is true, that baseball integrated before any other major institution in American society, Satchel Paige played a bigger role than anybody but Jackie Robinson, and maybe than Jackie Robinson, in integrating this sport. If Jackie was the father of baseball integration, Satchel was undoubtedly the grandfather.